Hi, I'm Sam Edis.
And I'm Amy Nelson. Welcome to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
This is a show about the world's most remarkable women, their professional and personal journeys.
Together, we'll hear from gold medalists, best-selling authors, and leaders of the world's most iconic brands.
This is a very exciting episode of What's Her Story with Sam and Amy because it is our second live Mom 2.0 version of What's Her Story with Sam and Amy. And Mom 2.0 is, Amy and I have a real passion for this conference. It's the number one conference for moms. We have attended in person many, many times. It's run by the extraordinary Laura Mays, and we're just both passionate about the audience and also just the agenda and everything that the conference gives us. And so we were so excited to introduce everyone today to Alicia Menendez, who is not just a TV anchor, but she also has a best-selling book. She's a mom of two, and we know that you will have a lot of things to glean from her wisdom.
Yes, and I'm sure you've seen Alicia on American Voices, on MSNBC on the weekends and the evenings, an incredible show that I tune into every week. But we have a lot of questions for you.
Alicia, one of the things that's tricky after reading your book, The Likeability Trap, is that I kind of like second guess all the things you say because I'm thinking, is she thinking about being likable in this moment? Do a lot of people say that to you?
No one has said that to me. Do not inception that into people's minds, Sam Edis.
But it's an interesting point, Sam. It really is. But I mean, well, to that point, though, he wrote The Likeability Trap. Why?
I care a lot about being well-liked. I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I'm a sensitive person. I am a Cancer, born in July. So it's like real deep Cancer. And I'm people pleaser. And, you know, part of that, I think, has to do with the fact that I am a woman who was raised in America. And across cultures, we socialize girls to think about themselves in relation to others. I think that can be a superpower. I think when that is empathy and consideration for others, there's nothing better. I think where it becomes a challenge for women and where it became a challenge for me was when everything I did and said was dictated and influenced by how other people would perceive it. And as I started to get into my 30s, I began to realize what that care for likability was costing me, both sort of emotionally, when I would put my head down at night and I would tick through every social interaction I'd had during the day and wonder what was awkward and what didn't land. The cost at work, where I felt I wasn't really showing up as the leader that I knew I could be. And so I originally imagined writing like an Eat, Pray, Love for Likeability, which would have been a much more fun book where I would have gotten to eat gelato and do yoga and let it all go. And instead, I interviewed women because that is what I do. And there were lots of women like myself who cared a lot, but there were also women who didn't give a damn. And what became interesting to me was that even those women, especially if they were ambitious, especially if they were in male-dominated fields, felt they paid a price for being so brazenly themselves. And so that question, like why, whether a woman cares or doesn't care, is she still running up against this expectation that she should show up in a certain way? That became sort of the core thing I wanted to grapple with.
It seems like it's not just the fact that you're a woman and that we all deal with this. And I'm sure so many of the moms listening right now are nodding their head vigorously. But also, you were the daughter of a New Jersey political operative. So your whole life, you grew up in politics. That must have also shaped your perspective on likability.
Yeah, I mean, when you are part of a public family, you know, I think there are so many of us that are raised to believe that when you go out into the world, you don't just represent yourself. You represent your immediate family. You represent your community. You represent so much more than yourself. That is was particularly acute because I was literally part of a public family. And as you know, because you have both worked in politics, a candidate's favorability determines whether or not they get to keep their jobs every 2 years, every 4 years, every 6 years. And so it was very real to me early on that being likable and being perceived favorably had a direct correlation to stability and job performance and And that is also part of what I wanted to grapple with, because I think it would have been really easy to write a book that was like, just don't care. Like, just like, let it go. Well, that's not actually how politics or business or the PTA works. People like doing things with people who they like, and that is real.
One question I had about what you just said, how old were you when you figured this out about the fact, the correlation between favorability of a politician and their job and being elected? Like, what did you take from that? Did someone explain it to you?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's so easy to look at it retrospectively and make it seem as though it was always crystal clear. I don't think I pieced together my personal attitudes about likability until I really started doing the work of this book. But I think it shows up in really subtle ways. Like, you know that your parent is vying for their job every year and a half. And you know that some of that is tied to how not only they show up, but you show up. Like, you are in campaign ads, you are in little pamphlets. Like, you know you are part of a package, and that package is being assessed and evaluated. And I think, you know, especially as you become a teen, and like every teen's parents in America are having conversations about like, don't do this, don't do that. There is this added layer of, you could be jeopardizing something that is not yours to jeopardize. And so I don't know that I was piecing it all together then, but I think when I look back at it now, that was definitely a piece of the larger puzzle about wanting to be well-liked. I think I would have been like this if I had a dad who was a school principal. Like, I think so much of this is baked into who I am, and so much of it is about being female and being Latina. Like, there is a huge cultural piece to this. You know, one woman I interviewed says Latinas are raised with a PhD in graciousness, that, you know, we are culturally expected to tend to others. And so I think there was a lot at play, of which that was one small piece.
How do you communicate this to your own children today?
Oh, I think about this all the time, and I'm not sure my children are quite yet old enough. I have two girls, they're 4 and 2. And so what I grapple with most is, there are people come to me and they'll say, well, why didn't you make this a parenting book? This could have been a great parenting book. And I understand that instinct, but that presumes that there is something that we can teach our children, that this is still an individual issue rather than being a structural and a systemic issue. So I do have, especially with the older one, because I have more of a sense of who she is, she tells you exactly what she wants. She demands exactly what she wants. She goes to the playground, climbs to the highest heights. She doesn't care if she gets dirty. She will tell you exactly what to do. And so my job is to preserve all of that. What I grapple with, and what I don't have a great answer for, is the fact that one day I will send her into a world that, as of this moment, does not reward girls and women for showing up in that way. Or it rewards girls and women up to a certain point, at which point they are told that they are too much, that they have to round off their edges, that they are too direct, too assertive. And what really wigs me out is that if she were the complete opposite, if she were really nice, like really like sort of was like, whatever you want, whatever's best for the group, she would be told that she was lovely and everybody loved her, but she didn't have what it takes to lead. And so that is what explodes my brain.
I think it's really interesting. Like, I personally have decided that I have to not care what people think in order to like have a career, right? Because I'm never going to be nice enough or direct enough or anything.
But I also, Amy, feel like I've watched you evolve through that in the past few years that I have known you, right? Like, I think that finding where that sweet spot is for yourself, especially when you are a public person, which increasingly so many more of us are, that I think it is unrealistic to imagine that women are going to be like, I know exactly the type of leader that I want to be. I know exactly the type of mother that I'd want to be. I know exactly the type of wife that I want to be. And I know how I want to curate my Instagram so that I can communicate this properly at all times to all people.
It's impossible. It's impossible. And I think that, like, I mean, I spent most of my life deeply caring what everybody thought, to the point where it held me back in a million different ways. And I just think that, like, you're not, like, I don't think that in this country we know how women should lead or who they should be. I think it goes exactly to what you're saying. Like, there's just no...
Well, I think that there's just so many options for men, right? They don't have to fit one mold. And I think that's what it is. And I think this actually leads me back to, it's the whole focus of a lot of my work, which is keep women in the workforce by showing them that there's a real path to having a successful professional and personal life. And only by showing them and giving them that vision can we keep more women in the workforce so that we do have more role models, so that it's not just the one woman at the top of the company that informs what other people think a leader looks like, right? So I think part of it is that there are so few female leaders to look to that we don't have the opportunity to say, that's, you know, one of thousands and thousands of women leaders that you have seen. And so I'm going to be one of those as opposed to the one.
Right. You can say, like, I'm more of a Roz than a Cheryl, right? That you had like so many names at your disposal that you could just pick them. I will say there was a profound moment, though, that happened during this past presidential election that I think sort of speaks to the future that you're envisioning. And that is that, as you both know, ordinarily when someone's name is in contention to be vice president or to be considered as a running mate, people generally demur, right? Like they go on the Sunday shows and people say, like, Amy, like, you know, it's being buzzed about that you could be, you know, the vice president. And people always be like, no, I'm just focused on, and then they list their portfolio. And this time you had all of these women and all of these women of color saying, yes, I'm very interested in that job. Yes, I think I would be great at it. Let me tell you why I would be great at it. And part of what's interesting is that that happened, period, that we were not accustomed to seeing that from anyone, much less a woman of color. But that also, they all did it, right? Like you watched all of them make the case for themselves, and that then became normalizing. No one stood out because they did that. And I think that that is where we want to be headed towards. That is at least the tiny piece of the puzzle that I think women themselves can control.
One thing that you mentioned early on, which really resonated with me, and I bet a lot of our listeners right now, is when you described yourself as like after a party or after a social interaction, you would lie in bed and be like, ooh, I wish I'd done that differently, and kind of rethinking all of your interactions. And I think that plagues so many of us. How have you overcome that?
I haven't, Sam. I'm going to go to sleep tonight and think about everything awkward I said today. But I think knowing that it has a name, it's called rumination, right? It's like you start with like a thought and all of a sudden it becomes about a thing that happened in the fourth grade and why I'm a terrible person and like everything is unraveling. But for me, it's about knowing that it happens and catching myself and breaking that pattern and saying, do you know that to be true or was that your perception of what happened? I am not great at it, which is also why across the board, one of my easiest, like you can do it today, number one recommendations, so obvious, you should have a WhatsApp chat, a group text, like whatever, Signal, whatever you feel, a group of people, in my case, a group of women, all happen to be Latina, lateral to me, who know what makes me great, who see my full potential, who also see where it is that I could improve, whom I can bring things back to and say, hey, this thing happened. Am I making a big deal of it? Or is there actually something that needs to be fixed here? And I find having a core group to whom I feel like it is totally normal that I go to with those questions and who I can trust that they won't just always be like, no, you're the best, you're the greatest, you didn't do anything wrong. People who can be real with me. I think that is like a very easy way to have a gut check.
And now for a quick break.
Talk to us about your identity as a Latina woman. You had a white mother. Do you ever feel or did you ever feel apologetic for the fact that you were, quote, half Latina? And I know that you married a Latino man. And how does all of this play out in terms of your own sense of identity?
It's part of what the term Latina, Hispanic, Latinx as catch-alls complicate, which is both of my parents are white, right? My father is Cuban, is of Cuban descent, but racially we are white across the board, which as a community in the conversation we're having with ourselves, there is privilege and hierarchy there. But my mom and dad raised us in a place that was overwhelmingly Latino. We grew up in Union City, New Jersey. It was where the Cubans who didn't go to Miami went. It was called Havana on the Hudson. By the time I was growing up there, it was a lot more Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, Colombians. And so most of the kids I went to school with, most of the people I went to church with, most of the people who lived in my neighborhood were Latino. And so to me, I was immersed in a way where I just thought it was a majority experience until I went to high school, and I went to a private high school outside of where I lived. And for the first time, I was like, where are all the other kids who have this experience? And was doing those translations that you do where, you know, my friend, I was dancing in my friend's quinceañera, which is her sweet 15. And one of my girlfriends at school very sweetly asked, well, does she not expect to live to 16? And it gave me the opportunity to explain, like, we celebrate at 15. It's a very similar celebration. But for the first time, I was the one doing all of that cultural translation for someone else. And yeah, it is important to me. It is how I see myself. I feel very anchored in it. Both of my grandmothers played a very large role in raising us. They were with us all the time. My paternal grandmother didn't speak English for most of that time, but we would like sit around and watch Spanish telenovelas together, and we would watch The Price is Right, and she would laugh at things that I didn't think she understood the joke about. So, you know, it's like, and it's there. To me, it is both a cultural identity, is a political identity, and one that I feel very, very grounded in. And one that now that I am a mother, I think a lot about how I make sure that my girls have that sense of pride, that sense of exposure, that sense of a people and a place that they come from.
So tell us about raising your girls. Like, where will they go to school? What's the community like that they're growing up in? You were in Miami, now you're in New Jersey.
So of course, Amy, you ask all the hard questions because the answer is, I don't know. Like, it's, I think in some ways you and I are probably in a similar spot on this, which is my husband and I had both been pretty transitory as people, and we loved that. Like, my husband was a campaign person. I think you did the Obama campaign. And so, like, he lived in Iowa and Texas and Puerto Rico. And even over the course of our relationship, we've lived Miami, DC, New York, and now in New Jersey. And so we're confronting that thing that you confront when you have been semi-nomadic, which is, what is fair for kids? How much of that can you do with kids and call it an adventure and know that they're adaptable? And, you know, before we had kids, we would talk about the fact that we were like, you know, we weren't raised with very much structure, and we want to give our girls structure, and like, there's going to be places for them to put things and systems and processes. And then we realized, oh my goodness, we don't know how to do that. Like, we would not be the right people to do that. And it helped us really value what we had instead, which was, you can throw us into any situation and we'll figure it out. You know, like, we will make it work. And I do value that, and I'm happy to give that to them. But I don't know the answers to a lot of those questions. Like, I've got a 4-year-old in pre-K-4. She's very happy there. But like, even when we talk about moving or anything else, she says she wants to live in this house forever, which we'll see.
I had this like very arbitrary thing. So I grew up in one community, went to one public school system my entire life, and just always envisioned that for my kids. And they're actually right now, they're in that public school system because we just moved to Ohio. But like, do I think they'll be there forever? No. Like, I just realized my husband and I are not those people. Like, to your point, like, we are going to be moving probably, you know, and my kids will get different bones than I had about who they are and, you know, their adventures and everything like that. But it might also be partly the world too. Like, the world has given us an ability to be more mobile as well. I mean, Sam, what would you say about all of that?
I think that kids require a certain level of stability, but that stability doesn't necessarily come from a physical place. It comes from feeling safe with their family, right? And so your family is home rather than the physical place being home. So I think the most important thing is for the kids to feel confident and stable. So that's number one. We moved our kids across the country when they were 1, 3, and 5. And now my kids are 15, 14, and 11. And when I even just talk about moving to a different part of Los Angeles, my 11-year-old freaks out and says he wants to live in this house forever. Alicia, there's two personal things I really want to ask you about. The first is about how you met your husband, because my understanding is that it was not love at first sight. And then the second thing as I want to ask you about is your parents' marriage and how that impacted you.
Well, let's see. We met, he had worked on the Obama campaign, and I was writing an article for a trade publication about the election. And he agreed to be interviewed because he was writing about the Latino vote. And he just clammed up. Like, he was giving me yes and no answers to questions that were not yes and no questions. And I was like, well, why did this guy agree to this interview? This is useless to me. And meanwhile, he's like, why is this woman being so pushy with me? Like, she's writing for a trade publication. Calm down. And then I went and worked at a think tank, and he went and worked at the White House, and he was my point of contact at the White House. And I always on the phone found him very brusque because he was working at the White House and he was like moving from thing to thing to thing. And I at that time was doing analysis spots on television. He was like, who is this child who is, you know, giving political analysis? And then we met in person. And I was just very struck by him. We had a group dinner together that night. I learned a lot about him, and it provided so much more context for me to who he was and why he was the way he was. And I think about it a lot in the context of, it's nice when we have strong feelings about someone, those strong feelings can move in either direction. And that very often, like, that reaction is about the fact that that person reveals something to us about ourselves. Like, in this case, I think it very much was that where we are different, we're very different, but where we are the same, we are very much the same. And I was responding to the parts of us that were actually very much the same, right? Where I'm like, why are you so loud? Why are you so direct? Why are you all of these things that I am too? And yeah, and then, you know, we started dating. We lived in DC for a while. We had a period of time where he got offered a job in Miami, and he moved to Miami, and I moved to New York, and we stayed together. And then I got offered a job in Miami, which, when you work in media, English language media, feels like a thing that will never happen. And so it really felt like the universe was aligning to make all of these very different things that we wanted actually line up. And it was a real blessing, because part of the reason we wanted to move there was he had a dad who was older. We got to spend 6 years, have both our babies in Miami. And his dad passed last year. And so I think about the fact that, like, we had so much time that wasn't a given. And that feels like such a blessing.
And then when you were in college, your parents got divorced. I think oftentimes when we think about divorce, we think of the impact on young kids. What was the impact on you as a college student?
I think sometimes we overframe divorce as just an ending, when you can look at divorce with an incredible sense of accomplishment. My parents were married for 27 years. That is a very long period of time. And so I look at that and I say, that's amazing. Like, you built a life, you built careers, you built a family, and we all have gone on to be happy and okay. And, like, I think that that is one of the elements of divorce that we don't talk about enough, which is, I think, like, it has worked out for everyone. And, you know, I think that is part of the lesson for me is, like, you work as hard as you can at it. And also, like, there is no shame in saying, like, this no longer works and this is no longer okay.
Speaking of parenting and parenthood, and circling back to your girls for a second, who is the primary parent for your daughters? Is there one?
I think, like, a lot of people where both parents work. My husband does he is outside in the morning for the school bus. He is he's often the one making dinner at night. Where there's a shift is in the mental burden. Like, I am still the one who's like, camp deadlines are coming up, got to register them for camp, or, you know, like, oh no, it's Tuesday, it's blue and orange day. We got to remember, like, all of the remembering, I think we would both agree, still falls to me. And part of that is personality, right? And the fact that, like I said, like, I, after I put my head down on the pillow and think about all of the things that, all of the strange social interactions I've had that day, the secondary thing I think about is, like, what are the things, who's the kid who I'm going to forget to bring to school tomorrow? Like, that is all the stuff that happens. But, you know, when we lived in Miami, I traveled a lot for work. And I really, that meant that he was the primary parent in terms of, if there is an emergency at school, who do you call? And I really had to train up the school administrators to understand, like, I know there was an emergency and I know you called me, but really there's a reason I put him down as parent A. And even one time I went into the school and one of the administrators was like, you know, your daughter told on you. She says that Carlos cooks dinner every night. And I was like, he does. He's like, he does. Like, that should be totally normal.
Wow.
But yeah. I mean, I don't know if you both feel this way, but I also think it's like, I think there are people who decide these are the types of people we're going to be, and then they are those people. And then there are people who feel their ways through life's experiences in the interest of figuring out who they will become on the other side of that. And I think part of, like, it's not just moving. It's like our lives have been in constant states of flux in multiple ways as it relates to our careers and what we do. Neither of us is the type of person who's been at the same job for 10 years. And so all of these things are things that we constantly reevaluate. And I would say week to week, day to day.
Do you feel like when you get to drop off in the morning or pick up your kids, like you're code switching? Like, now I am in mom mode and I'm trying to make mom friends. What has that been like for you?
I feel like I have made a real decision to show up as this person. This, and by this person, I mean a person who works and a person who mothers all of the time. In part, that is because of the nature of my work, where sometimes I'll be at the bus stop being like, hold on, I just gotta take a call. Like, I have to fuse both of those things. And because I want to be friends with the type of mom who's okay with that, even if she's not living that life herself. And I also feel like there is a unique privilege of the work that I do and the position that I'm in, which is, it's not a normal job, right? It's not normal in the sense that it's not like in an organizational structure, you can see who manages me and who I manage and like who then is looking to me for leadership. I'm a floating entity as it relates to my job at MSNBC. And so I think about the fact that, like, being honest about the fact that, like, I'm not going to put on my video for this call because my kids are running around in the background. Or I am going to put on my video for this call and you're going to see my kids running around in the background. Or I need to hold on for 1 second. I have a child who's asking for something. Like, I feel like that is both a privilege, right? Not everyone gets to do that, depending on where you are in your career and in your company hierarchy. But it also is to me a responsibility, right? Like, I have the capacity to normalize that for other people and to say, of course I get it that you have a kid, or of course I get it that you have caretaking responsibilities, and that is going to happen alongside all of the work that you do. And I do think that was one of the advantages of the pandemic, is that, like, for those of us who try to keep things very neat and tidy and very separated, it was no longer possible in ways that in many ways were detrimental to us. But where I look for a silver lining, that silver lining was we had to face the fact that people were trying to do and be a lot of things all at once.
And now for a quick break.
So I want to ask a question about your career. How did you end up in front of the camera? Was that your goal?
No, I thought I would graduate from college, go to law school, even took the LSAT. I basically was going to live your life, Amy Nelson, and then run for office. And I was working on campaigns and working on press side of stuff, and just realized how, like, we on the campaign were trying to set a narrative every day, but really the press was deciding what the narrative was that was set. And as someone who had never had a plan B, like, all of and had never thought about the fact that there was more than one way to influence people and have impact than the way that was right in front of me by virtue of growing up in a house with two public servant parents. And that all of a sudden became fascinating to me. I was like, well, what are they doing over there? How do you even do that? What are jobs that would look like? And I got myself, I think off of Craigslist, that's how old I am, a job at a television station in Westchester booking guests. And I booked guests for a political talk show. I learned what makes a great guest. I learned a lot I know about producing by being in that newsroom and asking questions like, what is MOS? It's man on the street. What is SOT? It's, it's sound on tape. I learned, that's how I also learn. Like, I don't necessarily learn by sitting in a classroom or reading a book. I learned by doing. And so it made a lot of sense. And then they let me do a few on-air things while I was there that gave me the confidence that I could do it. And then as I want to do, it's like, well, I think I'll just go work at Rock the Vote and, you know, try to affect change there. And part of what ended up happening was that because I had a little bit of that grounding in production and television than when they needed someone to go on TV as an analyst, as someone who could speak on behalf of the organization. I started doing that. And that led me down this path. And the biggest challenge of my career was trying to swing into not being an organizational person or a political person or a policy person, and instead being a full-time media person, meaning having a job in media that paid me full-time. And that came in 2012 when the Huffington Post launched their streaming network. And that was where I had my first hosting job.
So we're going to do a speed round, ask you some fun, more lighthearted questions. Okay, Alicia, what book are you reading right now?
Phoebe Robinson's, I believe it's called You May Not Sit on My Bed in Your Outdoor Clothes. That approximates the title. Also, Minda Hart's Right Within. Highly recommend.
Who leaves you starstruck?
Oh, Oprah.
What is your morning routine?
Okay, so the two-year-old wakes up and comes and wakes me up. And we go downstairs together, and she asks for a yogurt, and then I give her a yogurt and plop her in front of the television, where I then check on all of my emails that have come in from the night before, read the news, get things ready for the big girl, who I then have to, because she's now like a teenager, we have to go wake her up in time for school, and bring her downstairs, get her fed, get her in her uniform, make sure she catches the bus, and then I start thinking about what my morning routine is like. My morning routine is very much dominated by other people at this point. If I'm lucky, I wash my face, brush my teeth somewhere in there.
Who is your dream person to interview?
Well, I would say Sonia Sotomayor is definitely up there. But I would also say that part of what I've learned doing so many interviews is, like, a great interview is a person who shows up on that day wanting to be interviewed. Like, there is nothing worse than when you're like, you have done this under duress, and I am now pulling everything out of you. Like, sometimes people be like, that was a great interview. And I'm like, that person showed up ready to talk. And sometimes I'm like, wow, I really prepared for that. And that was a nothing burger.
So Lou is joining us. He's our male perspective on the show. And Lou has been listening to the entire conversation. And now he's going to ask a question.
Being a public figure is something that I know nothing about. You know, and when we interview people, sometimes we ask questions that they don't want to answer, you know, because they don't want that part of their life exposed or whatever. I don't know. Maybe they just want to keep it private. Why do public figures do that? Why do they not want to share that? Is this something that happened that you saw? You was like, I don't want that to happen to me.
I think that even when we're public people, there are things to us that are so precious, things we love so much, that we want them to be our own and we don't want to share them. And I think we have gotten to a place where we expect public people to bleed for us and in front of us. And I don't think that that is a fair expectation. And I think in general, we are all rethinking our relationship to privacy. I think that is something that sort of the proliferation of social media and the fact that we all think we look into each other's lives, see each other's lives, has just fundamentally shifted. I think about it a lot now, Lou, as a parent, where I'm like, how much of my kid's life is it fair for me to share? And so in as much as I'm grappling with these questions, I think we're all living through a moment where we are increasingly all thinking about how much of ourselves do we want to share? How much of sharing ourselves serves us? And what of our life is truly our own? And what is shared? And what sharing is actually sharing a little too much?
Thank you so much, Alicia.
Thank you, Alicia. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you all. All right. Bye.
What did you think of that?
I mean, so I know Alicia a little bit, and she is a brilliant, thoughtful voice and a leader. And I felt like that podcast was a rumination on a lot of really tough topics that impact all of us. And she's got a real voice. I mean, I feel like I need to walk away and think about everything that we just talked about. How about you?
I really loved when she talked about how transient, like, she and her husband are, but that they thought they should have these, like, really stable lives for their kids, and that they realized that's just not who they are. That was so fascinating.
Her husband's awesome. Carlos is, like, this brilliant, super fun guy. I mean, I knew him many years ago, but incredible person. And, you know, he's also from a political family.
Right, right. His grandfather was the president of Cuba.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, it's really interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would imagine that's something they had in common is that they're both from these wildly political families.
Well, and it's interesting for Alicia, too, because she's both a journalist who needs to be, you know, hand, like what she said, not part of the news, but kind of, you know, reflecting on it, and the daughter of a sitting U.S. senator. And I think, I don't know, you know, like, who else is that in America? Who else is in that?
Well, actually, the only people who are like that are the Cuomos, because if you think about it, like, there's a politician in office and then a media person who's covering it. So, you know, that's probably the only comparable I can think of right now where you have a media personality that's direct kin with a politician.
Well, Maria Shriver and when Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, I mean, but I think it's a very rare position to be in.
That's true. I also really found the likability thing fascinating because, you know, especially as moms, we're so aware of ourselves and our personalities in relation to other moms, to colleagues. Like, I feel like there's this added layer of complexity when you're a mom, right? Especially as your kids get older. Like, sometimes your kids are best friends with someone, and so you become friends with their parents, and then maybe that friendship dissolves, and does the friendship between you and the mom survive? Like, there's so much going on in the mom world in terms of friendships and interactions. And so I really enjoyed hearing about the likability as it pertained to that. And I appreciated what Alicia said about how she doesn't code switch at all. She's kind of like, this is who I am. Take me or leave me. Like, I'm the mom who's going to be on a call at the bus stop. And that if you like that, then let's be friends.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. I think that's really great. I love it. Thanks for listening to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
We would so appreciate if you would leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, connect with us on social media at What's Her Story Podcast.
What's Her Story with Sam and Amy is powered by my company, The Riveter, at theriveter.co, and Sam's company, Park Place Payments, at parkplacepayments.com.
Thanks to our producer, Stacey Para, our social media manager, Phoebe Crane-Fuss, and our male perspective, Lou Burns.